Good evening. My name is Wilhelm, and this is the 24th episode of the Nordnordost podcast, and the 12th episode if you're following the track in English. Last weekend, Elin and I went and visited Pete, and while we were there, we recorded a podcast episode with Pete and one of the players from his playtest group for the upcoming 6th edition of RuneQuest. And as usual with the Nordnordost podcasts, the discussion followed no real red thread, but skipped back and forth between various topics. But somewhere in the middle, we ended up talking a bit about RuneQuest. And I think that some people might want to hear only that part and not our extended discussion on indie gaming. So I decided to cut that bit out of the general episode and post it as a separate episode covering only that bit.
So as I was...
If we have that question, maybe you could say a few words on what RuneQuest is, because I'm not certain that everyone knows what it is.
Okay.
For me, it's... Oh, I heard that name before. It's a fancy game, right?
Yes.
Sword and Sorcerer.
Yes, maybe I'm getting it mixed up with some other game, but I think there's some gods there, and that lightning plays a role somehow with runes, and...
I am sure runes are not at all involved in RuneQuest.
No, and maybe trolls, and someone has a spear. Yeah.
Okay, so RuneQuest was one of the earliest role-playing games ever produced. It was the direct result of a bunch of guys who were playing Dungeons and Dragons, and they didn't quite like the way the game system worked. So they started coming up with their own house rules, which is pretty normal for when you play a role-playing game. And this list of house rules was called the Perrin Conventions, because it was compiled by a guy called Steve Perrin. Anyway, he got asked if he would be interested in developing a role-playing game based on these concepts. And so what he did is he went off and he developed this idea that there were no character classes, that you're just defined by the skills that you're good at and by the cults and gods that you worship. And this entire game ultimately became RuneQuest. It was indelibly linked with the world, the fantasy world of Glorantha, which was created by Greg Stafford. And Glorantha is this mishmash, hodgepodge of wonderful world mythologies all kind of beaten into this fantasy land where there are no objective truths. There are only subjective truths, and all mythology are subjective. And so you can have a myth that can be true for different cultures, even though they view the myth in slightly different ways. And they have different names for the gods, and those gods do truly exist. As long as you have enough believers who believe in them, they do exist. And the idea that you can actually change objective reality by performing a hero quest to change the mythology of how this thing works. So there aren't true physics as such. Why things fall to the ground when you throw them up in the air is dependent on the mythology of, say, the earth god, and why he's jealous of his possessions and always tries to draw them back to himself, rather than a scientific concept of gravity. Gravity doesn't exist. It's the mythic reality that is important. So anyway, Glorantha was an interesting world, but RuneQuest was this very strange game system for the time because it lacked character classes. And one of the biggest issues that people had when they first started playing with it was they liked the character creation, they liked the idea that there were skills and there were not particularly character classes, until they got to hit points. And in RuneQuest, you don't get any more hit points when you go up levels, because there are no levels. You only improve your skills. And this was a terrible break point for a lot of players because they felt horribly vulnerable all the time because quite literally one lucky shot could kill off your character. Now, of course, back in the old days of role-playing, you lost characters on a very frequent basis anyway. But at least in Dungeons & Dragons, once you got beyond maybe 5th level, the chances of you dying grew gradually less. And you knew the system, you could pretty much avoid your fate if you were clever about it. But in RuneQuest, it was just that, oh dear, you got a critical roll against you, you're doomed kind of thing. And I honestly think it was that which caused the game not to be quite as popular and to not trash Dungeons & Dragons completely. It may sound a bit weird, but at least when I first played RuneQuest, that was the first thing that hit me between the eyes. But
when did you encounter RuneQuest?
83, I think. Around about then. I think it was about the same year that the fighting fantasy book Death Trap Dungeon came out. So if Death Trap Dungeon came out in 83, that was the year I started playing RuneQuest. But despite that, RuneQuest became intensely popular with those players who liked the idea of active defences and who liked the idea of getting better at skills. Because, of course, Dungeons & Dragons lacked a skill system other than thievery. You had to sort of abstract that kind of role-playing and make a lot of house rules and decisions about how your character could do things. Because they weren't any skills.
And that's what the old school Renaissance is about right now.
Yes.
Throw out the skills.
throw out the skills, make it up as you go along. Which is great. And that is an interesting aspect in future game development. I'll talk about game development of RuneQuest 6 a little later on. And RuneQuest plodded on quite nicely. RuneQuest 2 is regarded as one of the most classic versions of the game. And then we had RuneQuest 3, which became a bit more technical. More skills, more mechanics were added. And everybody thought that this was a good thing at the time. And most people played with it. There were a few aspects of the system which were a little bit unbalancing or broken. But in general, RuneQuest 3 was a worthy successor to RuneQuest 2. But it had a big difference, which was that it no longer associated itself with Glorantha as a default setting. It had tried to break free of Glorantha as the setting. So now it was an independent gaming system, which you could then use those rules for other games. Whereas Glorantha was still the primary fantasy world that you could use RuneQuest for, but it was no longer firmly chained together. And a few years earlier, you had the first split off from RuneQuest, which was Call of Cthulhu.
Oh.
Most people have played Call of Cthulhu. Call of Cthulhu is effectively RuneQuest, but brought up to the 1920s. The skills slightly modified, combat greatly simplified, and it has been one of the most successful horror games of all time.
Yeah.
And it's still being played very highly today, and still regarded very highly today.
And it has become popular in Sweden.
Yes.
Yes. Not everyone, but most people have played Call of Cthulhu at some point, and in some shape and form. It has been very popular to run events at conventions and call them Call of Cthulhu, and when you get there, they're not Call of Cthulhu. There are just random horror games, diceless, freeform stuff, and people call them Call of Cthulhu to draw interest.
Yes.
But did RuneQuest... Has RuneQuest ever been a Swedish game?
Far as I'm aware, and from what other friends who are Swedish roleplayers have told me, the concepts of RuneQuest were adopted by demons and...
Drakar och demoner. Dragons and demons.
Yeah.
And Dragons and Demons took the RuneQuest ideas and mechanics and then threw in all of the advanced Dungeons and Dragons stuff for atmosphere and colour and blended it into its own unique game. Yeah. And from what I heard, the game has dominated Swedish role-playing for the best part of two decades. And so I think that's why RuneQuest never took off in its own right here, because it had already been supplanted by somebody who'd taken the core elements of it and used it into his own version, which is great, because D100 systems are my favourite type of gaming, because I find that they vanish into the background very easily, so they don't interfere with my gaming, because I like to role play. I don't generally like to roll dice all the time.
Working with percentage is very easy,
it's
mentally.
Very easy. And for me, when RuneQuest 3 came out and showed the way that you could actually adapt the core rules to basically any kind of genre you could think of, that was wonderful. Because soon after, we had things like Ringworld, which was a sci-fi system. We had Superworld, which was a superhero-based D percentage system. And they all took ideas that were developed in RuneQuest and just applied them, came up with some new rules for them, and ran with it. And so little tweaks here, little tweaks there, and it's continued to evolve. And a few years back, we had BRP produced, which is basic role-playing. And so what they did was, quite early on, they took the core elements of a D100 game and they called it basic role-playing. And now they produced a big book which had all the different incarnations of the D100 system. And they've taken all the rules out of those and threw them into one big toolkit. And it was for BRP, which I wrote my first gaming book. So that was pretty much the apex of at least Chaosium's D percentage system. Now, I myself continued to tinker with the rules, and I was involved in a shared world creation project, a game world we called Gwenthia, where everybody brought over their favourite fantasy and weird science aspects from all the games they liked, and we tried to hammer it into a unified whole in one world, which was an interesting experience, and I wouldn't necessarily say it was completely successful, but it was very, very educational, especially about how to work with other people, especially when it was their idea that was under scrutiny. And so whilst we were working on this, we tried to figure out which game system we would use for it, and eventually had a grudging consensus that it would be Mongoose's relaunch of RuneQuest, which wasn't very successful in its own right and wasn't very popular. Definitely came a too many cooks spoiled the broth sort of group game design in a game.
In a bad way.
Yes, the playtest was open to just about everybody, and that didn't work very well because, of course, you couldn't get a universal acceptance of any particular aspect of the system. So whatever they chose, they were going to get crucified for.
Isn't there another company who does that sort of playtest right now?
I'd not like to mention any names at all in this situation. But I didn't like the way that combat worked, and I certainly couldn't see a way of creating all of these new magic concepts that people had come up with for their part of the world. And so I developed brand new ones with the help of some of the other main participants, Lawrence Whittaker, my co-author, being one of them. And we worked very hard. And I just shut myself in a room basically for 2 weeks to try and create a new combat system, which I thought was far more entertaining and fun, and released it to the RuneQuest community to just run with. Here, have this. It's a new tool. You might enjoy it. And I got contacted by a bunch of French guys who were doing the translation for Mongoose's RuneQuest, and they said, well, we actually like your combat system much better than the Mongoose combat system. Can we use yours, please? Said, yeah, if you want it, go ahead. So that was all great and good, and I was developing my own miniature fan base around this. And then Lawrence Whittaker, gained full-time writing position for Mongoose, and he started out with the Elric game. And I helped him develop the magic system for Elric. It was a great deal of fun. And after a while, a year or so working for Mongoose, he was given the opportunity to redo RuneQuest, because RuneQuest still wasn't particularly popular. It was kind of dying a bit of a death in the company product line. And I said, okay, but you've got to give me some time, and do you mind if I get some outside help for it? And Matthew Spring said, yeah, go for it. And so Lars came to me and said, hey, Pete, all this, can we use your combat system, and shall we work together on the magic system for? And then we just seem to work really well as a team. I come up with weird ideas, and he stomps on my weirder ideas, and I stomp on his what I consider mechanically broken ideas, and we basically thrash it out between the two of us. But we do it in a nice, friendly way, and we don't kind of like end up hating each other, which is the important bit. And at the end of it, we had Mongoose RuneQuest 2, which was popular, and people said, hey, okay, Mongoose has finally got on the right track, and this works as a gaming system, and has fixed a lot of the problems in previous versions of RuneQuest, and was generally a success for Mongoose. Wasn't as great a financial success as they'd hoped, but unfortunately, they'd already shot themselves in the foot with the first release, and so they'd driven away a fair amount of customers, and it was a lot of hard work to draw them back with this newer version. And since then, Mongoose lost the license to RuneQuest, and Lars and I went, well, we'd quite like to have a shot at it, because I think we've shown that we're kind of working in the right direction, and perhaps we can present it in a different way and give it an extra few tweaks, which we weren't allowed to in the previous version because of lack of page space, and see if we can give the fans something that is more flexible and more suitable for everything from weird science, sword and sorcery, all the way to high fantasy and even science fiction. Because I've run Star Wars with RuneQuest 6, even though I had to change a few skill names and such, but it was still flexible enough to adapt to that with very little work. And so that's the kind of history of the development of RuneQuest, where I've left out a huge amount of stuff in the middle story, and I hope I haven't upset anybody by ignoring their efforts on the route. RuneQuest 6 itself has been a very educational experience, because it's the first book where I've had to do, where Lars and I have had to do everything from the ground up. So not only the writing, but we've done a lot of editing and proofing, and Lars has been a genius when it comes to all the layout stuff, and very steep learning curve for learning things like InDesign and Adobe, which are all nightmare pieces of software to try and get into. But we've retained creative control over the content and this art illustrations, which are very important to us, because Mongoose have made some questionable decisions in the past about the style of art that they put in their books, which reflected badly against the game, which was a shame, because you'd hope that people would actually read the game itself rather than pick it up and go, ugh, cheesecake art, and cast it aside. But people aren't like that. First impressions count. And so this time we've tried to make sure that the art is generally nicer and more inspirational. But this has been a very illuminating sequence, from the difficulties of running a correct playtest and the difficulties of getting playtesters to really playtest the material fully, all the way through to volunteers are wonderful, and we love them volunteering, but sometimes they just can't deliver, especially when you're trying to maintain a professional deadline, which is very tough. And it's all done now, and there's been many headaches en route, and it's taken about 3 months longer than we expected it to. But the book has proved to be far more inclusive of much more material than we'd first thought. And I'm hoping people will like it. And hopefully we've created a good introductory character to take you through the character creation process and rule illustrations all the way through. A female warrior to rival Rurik the Reckless, who was the character in the original RuneQuest 2. And we've also done things like ask Steve Perrin at give us a foreword to the book as well, to recognise the fact of his contribution to the genesis of the game. Without him, it would never have existed.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people should... I suppose when Gygax died, there was a big outpouring. Everybody had played Dungeons & Dragons in one form or another. When Steve Perrin dies, hardly anybody will notice, which would be a terrible tragedy, because without him, we wouldn't have games like Call of Cthulhu. It was his game design that kind of allowed all of that kind of stuff to happen. But we're there. Yesterday I finished off all the hyperlinks in the e-book version of it. Print version has already been sent off. And we're just waiting for it to actually be printed. And it'll be sent to the distributors automatically. And hopefully it'll be in game shops whenever. We don't actually know when it will get there. And hopefully this coming week I'll get my first proof copies from the printer to just read through and go, oh, damn, there's something I missed. Which will be inevitable. But what can you expect in a book of that kind of size? But I'm hoping that the quality will impress people. I'm hoping that the material will impress them. And I'm hoping that they see what Loz and I have done to loosen up some of the rules and mechanics to make the game system really flexible, which is an aspect of game design where you could probably use most role-playing games for most genres if you were willing to just change a few skill names and put a few new items in there. But magic systems are the biggest stumbling block, because every author under the sun writes their game world with different ways of using magic. So Ursula Le Guin has the wonderful sort of like word-based magic, and then we go all the way through to the Vancian style magic from the Cujo books and things like that, where you basically have to ram a spell into your head, and like if you can memorize three or four, and they're very weird one-shot strange things which can be used in inventive ways, but they only work in one way mechanically. And you come along with a role-playing game system and it's got magic written up in one way, in one mechanistic way, and you're going, I'd love to run this genre, but I can't make the magic work. And that's always been a really, really big pain in the backside. And so for nearly all the game books I've ever written, especially the historical ones, I've always had to create a new magic system for every single setting, which is fun, but it makes life difficult. And so for RuneQuest 6, we've tried to make sure that magic is far more adaptable and can very easily be twisted, tweaked, strengthened, weakened, whatever, to make it work for anything you can think of. To the point where I said, I have used it to run Star Wars scenario. Because what I can do is I can use the mysticism magic as Jedi powers. Easy as that. Because the fundamental concepts are very similar. It's just a matter of how many force points do you get and how quickly do you regenerate them.
Is the magic system your little favourite part?
I still... The breaking open of the magic system so it can be adapted to different genres is one of my favourite parts. My other favourite part is still the fighting. Mechanistically, it's I roll to hit, you roll to parry. Whoever gets the better level of success, or if there is a difference in level of success between us, extra things can happen. And these are called special effects. And that can be anything from disarming you to knocking you backwards so you stumble backwards to... Yeah.
They make things happen.
They make things happen. And they are fundamentally based on my own experiences of fighting. Now, I've been studying martial arts of various different types for almost as long as I've been role-playing. And I've been role-playing for 30 years. And to the point now I actually teach fighting, whether for true fighting, sort of, or replicating maneuvers and techniques which are found in the fighting manuals, which are still existing from the 15th, 16th centuries, all the way through to the SCA. I'm a knight and a royal peer in the SCA, which is, funnily enough, the origin of RuneQuest combat in the first place, because it was Steve Perrin himself was a knight of the SCA, Society for Creative Anachronism. So it's kind of gone full circle that a combat guy who wrote the system wrote the original RuneQuest and conceived the original RuneQuest, and now I'm doing the combat at the other end of it, at the end of its, well, at this current point in its evolution, because I'm sure there will be people who will take the RuneQuest system after Loz and I have passed on the baton, and I'm sure.
And there will be some combat person along.
Yeah. And the nice thing about the combat system is that there's a bit of a disconnect with people who just like to watch Hollywood movies or read combat in a book, and real life experiences by people who really do practice the art, not just as a sporting martial art, as it sort of is in the SCA, but as a real recreating the historical art as far as we can.
Yeah, if you look at Asian Japanese martial arts, the difference between a jutsu and a do.
Yes, very similar to that.
Yeah.
Because once you turn it into a sport,
you
warp the art itself, and you start to change it, because as a sport, it has to be safe.
Yeah.
And once you start making certain maneuvers and techniques forbidden, because they're too dangerous,
yeah,
then you're really fundamentally changing the nature of combat.
And even when you just change a technique, that changes twist.
Yeah. So if you look at an Olympic fencing tournament, for example, that is nothing like what a duel would have been like in the 17th century. In no way, shape or form. That's how much it has, I hate to use the word, it has been perverted, but it has been radically changed. Now, it's great as a sport, but yes, it's not a true fighting art anymore. Now, the nice thing I find is when I get real reenactors or people who do know the deeper levels of fighting, who come along and go, wow, this RuneQuest combat system is really interesting, really cool because of the things I can do in it.
And it's not just a hit point ping-pong match.
Yeah, it's not just hit point ablation. And the thing about it is I can hit, you can parry, and yet I can still do something interesting to you, which is just like in real life. My biggest problem with combat in role-playing games in general is that it generally ends in death and severe injury during the fight to actually get anything done. And that shouldn't be the case at all. I should be able to throw a shot at you, you might be able to parry it, but I can still put you on the ground and say, I've won this fight, do you want to submit now? And if you can't do that in a combat system, there's something wrong with the combat system. Because most combats in history don't end in people getting killed. And in fact, needless death is
avoided by all professional soldiers.
By most cultures.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous to allow people to go around killing other people all the time. And inherently, as human beings, we find it very difficult to kill other people when it comes down to it. You have to be driven by a very strong passion to be able to put that blade into that person. Now, it isn't just a case of, oh, you stole my boots and you ran off with them. You're not going to put a knife into his lung for that.
Yeah.
You beat him up a bit. You might scare him, but you certainly get your boots back. But it's generally not the case that you'll kill him for it.
Oh, when people do die, it's from falling over during a fight and hitting their head. That's a really large number of death in fights.
Or simply by accident.
Or maybe infection a few days after the fight. There's plenty of examples of Renaissance period duels where one guy lunges and impales his opponent on his blade and goes, ha ha, I have won. And then his opponent kind of looks quizzically down and goes, "You bastard," and sticks his sword through his phone, and they both die. It's just like, it may take them a few days of horrible agony as the infection takes hold, but it was kind of like incidental to the actual fight itself.
Yeah.
And yet, it's very strange.
Yet that kind of realism is not generally that sort of dramaturgy you want in a game. We fought the trolls and then I died 5 days later from an infection.
You don't really want that to happen. But then again, I think there has been a dearth of the psychology and social repercussions of fighting in role-playing games. Because, you know, originally it was just killing your opponent. It developed out of wargaming. You know, you kill people to win the battle. It's a casualty. And now it's come to an implicit, we kill monsters to defeat them. And what I'm trying to show in RuneQuest is that you can defeat an opponent without even causing them an injury if you're that way inclined. And so you can have the Three Musketeers swashbuckling type of thing, where there aren't actually that many bit part characters who die in the book at all. And in some of the movie representations, you see the king's men get injured, but not that many of them actually die. Yet, more modern interpretations, people are getting chopped down left, right, and centre. And you have to wonder, okay, what is it with all this unnecessary killing? You don't need to kill them. In fact, if you're that good a swordsman and you fling your sword around in front of them in a very flashy kind of way, you should be able to intimidate them into giving up the fight straight away. Why don't we embrace that more in our role-playing games? Why is it that we are so bloodthirsty in our games? And it's not something that occurred to me when I was young. When I was young, it's like the murder hobo style of gaming was definitely in vogue. I mean, it was implicit in the game books and we just followed suit and we just cut down everything in our path. Kicked in the door, killed the monster, looted the body, and ran off and spent all our gold on getting XP. Well, that was great.
Yeah.
But as I've grown older, I've become more and more aware of this. As it's not a bad thing, because effectively when we play role-playing games, we're having our own escapism. We like to kill things. It's just one of those bad aspects of sort of...
We have our reptile range down there on the surface.
We like to kill things in fantasy. I mean, you just need to look at a computer, modern computer game, and you know it's true. So it's not necessarily bad to have unnecessary levels of killing in games. It's just that I'd really like my game system to be able to support a more mature or greater reality to my fantasy, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Because killing... Okay, how many heroes are there in the world? How many monsters do they kill per year? How fast do that goblins produce? Well,
if you want to introduce logic to your fantasy game, then...
But it can get to leave levels when it's silly.
I don't think I'm as such, is the customer, the intended customer for this game, the RuneQuest.
Mm-hmm.
No. But now that you speak of this combat system that doesn't necessarily end in character death, maybe I should take a look at least and try this and see what happens. Because that is something that I've had a problem with, just as you had, that good stories don't necessarily work that way, that the hero fights and kills everything that comes in his path, and
if he don't kill it, he dies.
Yes, and that's the stakes of our confrontation. Either you die, or I die, or in worst case...
both dies.
Yes. someone, a friend, proposed a combat system for playing samurai. And it was like this. We roll a d6. On a 1 to 2, I win. On a 3 to 4, you win. On a 5 to 6, both die.
Ooh.
And that was the combat system.
Russian roulette.
Yes, with horrible odds.
Horrible.
But when we acknowledge that death isn't necessarily what we are fighting for. We are fighting for victory, and that may involve death, but that mm-hmm. isn't specifically so. I'm playing in a Song of Ice and Fire game, and that game has a combat system that works sort of in that way. You can win without killing. And it struck me as interesting. So now comes my follow-up question. How many combat rounds are we talking about until we know who won? Two fighters enter a room. How many rounds of combat will they fight before we know who won?
Are they both experienced fighters with a lot of armor?
Yes, of course. They are experienced fighters wearing armor and have good weapons and training. And
in that case, you're maybe looking at two or three rounds.
I would say three to four. With my experience with it.
And how long does the round take?
Yes, between two components.
Two opponents.
Two opponents.
Fast. Generally, most people who are into fighting will have three actions during the round. So that generally means I attack you, you parry me. You attack me, I parry you, and then I might be able to attack you back. And so each point means one interaction during that round. It just depends on how the combat is set up. So between two people, that will generally mean
nine exchanges. Then nine times I will roll the dice to see if I.
Personally, I would say that would be at most, because I've worked very carefully on the probabilities of what happens and how often a combat maneuver comes up. And usually, even between two experienced people, there will be some special effect happening, maybe one in three, one in four times per round.
So, fight with the whole party. Normal fight. How will that long take?
Yeah, the four PCs walk in the forest, and they are attacked by robbers, like six or eight robbers, the usual.
Usually less than 10 minutes for us.
10 minutes.
And but you are the designer of the game, and you have played it a lot. The new group.
I've played it for less than a year.
Yeah. The new group. It's not their first session. The first session is only to teach the game. But the second session, when this is done, last time we did the duels, we know how it works. We will now play this combat with four pieces.
I think the first and second sessions will be much slower.
Yeah.
Because the whole combat system is based around these special effects. And what I recommend anybody doing is going to our website and printing off the document we have there with the special effects already pre-laid out.
Oh, yeah.
And you just hand that straight out to your players and say, okay, these are the things you can choose. And there's a little table that shows you when you can use them. And then it will take 2 to 3 sessions for people to find what their favorite kind of techniques are.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not all equal, and they have different applications. For example, last Monday we were having a fight against, strangely enough, two heavily armored samurai creatures. They weren't human, but they were dressed head to foot in samurai armor. I was looking at them and I was thinking, it's going to take me forever to try and chop them down with my sword. So what I did was, instead of attacking with my sword, I attacked with my shield. I got the winning blow, and I just knocked the creature off the side of the bridge using the bash special effect. I knocked him straight off the bridge into the water, and at which point he went glug, glug, glug. So, game over.
And I stole the technique and knocked the other one off.
Yeah.
And we finished that fight in 2 rounds.
Yeah. And that was actually inherent in the system. You didn't have the GM produce a special case, a special rule interpretation.
Nope.
It's there in the system.
It's built in.
Yep.
Now, I do love playing looser games, a bit like Hero Quest, where, okay, it's down to a dice roll, but what I'm doing is I'm verbally describing what I'm doing, and the GM may give me a bonus according to the depth of my explanation.
Yeah.
Or how impressed he is by what I'm trying to do. And that's great. But I can only keep that up for about a session or so. And then after a while, your descriptions will have less and less mechanistic effect, and it becomes more and more effort to maintain that over a campaign. It
gets repetitive.
It gets very repetitive and quite tough to sustain. Whereas what it done in RuneQuest, which is a slightly more mechanistic system, is I've built those things in automatically so that you don't have to spare any role-playing effort in describing the fighting because it's all there for you. You just pick the effect you want and bang, there it goes.
Is it room in the system? Oh, there are 21 options listed, but I came up with the 22nd. Is it easy to...
You can add extra ones, but I think I've been fairly comprehensive because I've tried to replicate every possible thing I've done and I've seen happen in combat.
Yeah, I don't think in my experience I have never had the need to make a combat maneuver up. And the RuneQuest is pretty much the only game I've played for this year.
So there's always room to design new ones, especially if you're going to use strange weapons and stuff like that. I mean, when I write a setting book for, say, science fiction gaming or a more modern genre, then I'm probably going to have to come up with a few extra ones for firearms, but I'm sure it's not actually going to be that difficult. So there's always room for creative people to put in their extra bits. And with the examples there, it should be easy to figure out what the balance is. That's the way I like to approach combat. I like the combat to be offloaded from my creative mind. So that's tactical. Fair enough.
I like that you will provide, or actually do provide already, or will provide handouts describing.
Yeah.
This is how it works, that you can give to the players, because having one book and, well, my rules are on this page and mine on this page, and I want to do my turn, give me the book, and so on.
Yeah.
And not having everyone buy the book.
No. We've specifically designed it so that only the games master needs to buy the book, and that all the very few tables and things that are in the game system are all just handout printouts. And we've written all of those up already, so they're going to be available free to download for anybody. Yeah.
And that's important.
Well, I personally believe in not wearing your book out when you're playing.
Yeah, but I also think it's important that if a game is going to spread, it must be to demonstrate.
Yes.
If you can't run it at a convention, you can't show it to new people.
I like to think that after somebody has played half a dozen combats using the game system, they really won't need to have the handouts anymore. They'll just know off the top of their head. But, the uptake will be a bit slow, but I think after the third session, everything should flow really quick. It doesn't take a lot. Once you've got the basic concept in your head, it's just a matter of getting used to using them.
And there are horribly slow, crunchy systems that takes forever to learn out there that sells well.
Yes. I find that I have less and less patience for learning games. I still find the time to play. I bring my friends in, we have a talk and we maybe read something and we play a game. But to find the time to learn the game.
Yes.
And I'm so helped by game designers who either in the book or on the website provide quick rule summaries, one or two pages that say, all right, you bought the system, this is how it works, full rule text, but just checklists for me that I can keep by me while we're playing. All right, the combat has these three phases, maybe references to any absolutely necessary tables, and like, that can help me and hold my hand as I go through the game the first few times.
Yeah.
For games that don't provide this, I have to write them myself because I will not be able to find the time to read the game, learn the game, and then keep that knowledge up to date until I manage to schedule the players to sit at the table and play with me. So I have to take the system and like read it and make notes. And I... Reading books and taking notes, I did that at university for 5 years. I'm done with that. I want a paved road from now on.
Yeah.
Don't want to bring that into your hobby.
No, learning or anything. God forbid. But no, to save, because time is scarce. I'd rather pay money to save time because games are cheap today. Mm-hmm. They are very, very cheap. Even the games that I look at, this game is expensive. The newest Swedish Sovinter game, it costs 400 krona in the store, and that means like it's 50 bucks, something like that.
Yeah.
If we convert to dollars, then, yeah. $50, 40 euros, something like that in the store. And this is an expensive book, but nah, it's not really that expensive considering if I play it for two sessions, it's
more than paid.
The price per either for me or if my players chip in, maybe they don't chip in by actually giving me money for the book, but they bring some soda and they bring some snacks and so on. So
yeah, or they bring some other games, some other time.
They bring some other games. So actually,
it evens out.
It evens out, and it's not really much money, but the time.
Yes.
I need to sit down and learn this game, and it, maybe you'll learn this no time, 5 or 6 hours. I could commit that in like 15 or 20 minute increments, going through a few pages every day. But to sit down for 5 hours with the book to actually study it, happens so seldom these days that I can find the time to do that.
We have taken that to heart, and for character generation, we do have a checklist page to make character generation easy. For combat, there is a small part page checklist there so that people just keep on top of how things work. And the game in general doesn't require very much in the way of preparation because, you know, you say, okay, this is the NPC, or this is the creature. Well, I'm just going to give it some skills at 70% and just say anything it does is at 70%. And as simple as that. Really.
And that is the strength of the basic role-playing D100 system, that it's so very easy to invent creatures and give stats on the fly.
Yeah.
It's very, very easy compared to some other games I play. We actually have to think a bit and prepare in advance if you don't want to stop the game entirely by it.
Or like with White Wolf, oh my god, the game makers don't know the mat in their own game.
Yeah, that's always an issue.
Yeah.
I bent over backwards to make sure that all the examples in the book are mathematically correct, but I'm sure I missed out one or two somewhere.
But I think to make a game available to a lot of people, it's important to have that ease access, or one road to ease access.
Yeah.
We had, at one lot, we had recruited this really cool group of LARPers. And one of them was going to play Mage, and we sent her or 80 pages magic document. And she said, no, I'm a dyslexic. I can't read this. And we had to reevaluate, why are we sending out 80 pages documents for the magic? In reality, we had to solve it by a half an hour phone call from the game master, and then it was done. Those 80 pages wasn't necessary. And like Wilper, you just don't have time. And not everyone will have the ability to read 400 pages of rules for a lot of reasons.
That is one thing I'm a little worried about. RuneQuest 6 book is it's 456 pages, but I'd like to think that we pack an awful lot of material into those 450 pages.
And a lot of people love reading 400 pages. The problem is when you reach a point, you can't be a part of the gaming group unless you read 1,000 pages of the core group and these supplements.
Anyone who is at the Game Master in RuneQuest really only needs to know the character creation and the special effects.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Which I have a problem calling special effects.
So, for 450 pages, but how much of this will I need to know when running my first game? Let's say, no wizards, magic rules are often a bit different. They add some special case and so on. So I will have a party of players, and no one plays a magician. You can be fighters, thieves, or...
Okay, well, the character creation section takes up a fair amount of space, but it's actually not that much you actually have to read, because some of it's background tables and...
skill lists.
And skill lists, yeah. And things, which are all pretty obvious. So you don't really need to read all of that.
Yeah.
In fact, you just go to the page where it's got the character creation checklist and you just work down it in order and it should be fine. Then you have the kind of mechanistic rules for what happens in the world. Say there's a fire, or say you fall off something, or you crash your chariot when driving too fast. So they're kind
When you need them, you look them up.
No one knows them by heart.
Precisely. You look them up when you need them. So they're one-off kind of things. Then you have the magic systems, and we have five different magic systems. Folk magic, animism, which is kind of spirits and such like. Mysticism, which is...
Jedi.
Everything up to and including Jedi.
Jedi monks.
Sorcery, typical dark sword and sorcery type sorcery. And then you've got Thaism, which is priestly magic, got magic from the gods kind of thing. So if you're not going to use magic, they all go out the window. Plus the chapter on how magic works, which is the one where you tinker how available magic is in the world. Plus the chapter on cults and... Oh no, actually, you probably use the cults and brotherhoods, because RuneQuest is a game that is driven by social... membership in things. So it used to be in RuneQuest 2 where you basically join the cult of Oranth, the storm god, which gave you some kind of ideas of how you're supposed to act in society, how you're supposed to worship your god, and the powers he gives you for being a nice guy. Well, similar thing with brotherhoods. Do you want to be part of the Black Company mercenary group? If so, these are the kind of rules they obey. These are the oaths they swear. These are the taboos they're not allowed to do. That kind of thing. And if you're a member of the mercenary company, will they help you in such and such a social situation? So that chapter would be useful. Then creatures. I think everybody would probably need the creatures chapter, but
you don't read all the creatures. You learn read the first bit, and then
it's situational.
And I will have some wolves in this game, so I'll check out, look up the wolf rules. But
so we have lots of different creatures, but we also have a good section on how to use creatures in a good way. It's not just, oh, you bump into a bear, you all hit the bear until the bear falls over, and it might claw one of you down in the process. It actually goes into, okay, how does a bear act? How will it attack you? When will it attack you? What will it do? Will it actually try to kill you? Or will it just try to scare you away? So we have kind of guidance there to try and make things like animal encounters more interesting. And not necessarily end in mindless death. Then after that, we have GM guidance. So if you're a games master, you probably would like to read it. But again, you don't have to if you're an experienced game master. So realistic. Oh, and of course, there's the combat chapter in there as well. And the combat thing is probably the biggest element of most role-playing games when it's in a fantasy situation. It's rare to find people who are willing to game totally on the social interactive level. Although I myself... I'm in medieval Japanese campaign, which is still going, and that's gone on since 89. we're now down to role-playing it once a year, because that's the only time we can get everybody together. And that has been played at the social level for many years. It's just like politics, with a little bit of fighting on the side every once in a while. But I have this guy who's now effectively become shogun of northern Japan, And I'm not allowed to fight because none of my Hatamoto will allow me to go anywhere near a dangerous situation. It's very frustrating for me because I want to chop things down every once in a while. But, you know, it's to the point where what we would do is we would go to Dave's house, we would relax, drink some sake, and then to the point where we'd even get off the sofas and kneel. And we could play one court session without a single dice roll, with us all exchanging sentences with multiple meanings attached to them. So there's the polite interpretation of what the sentence means. There's the implicit hidden meaning if you knew the right words and if the person was in the know about certain situations. Then there was the maybe inherent insulting nature of the way you presented it. So there were only multiple levels of communication in one sentence.
And that's fantastic.
And our heads were in a completely different zone. And that was fantastic levels of role play.
Yeah.
And yet we didn't need to roll a single dice. And I love that kind. But it's quite rare to find groups who can achieve that. I mean, yes, you can play completely political games with RuneQuest, as is. But, you know, RuneQuest has always catered to combat as being...
That's not the focus of the game.
Rules-wise, not. Yeah.
So, I see... The situation used to be that we provide combat rules for combat, and you will role-play social situations.
Mm-hmm.
And these days I see some games that provide similar importance in the rules to both. We provide one set of rules for physical combat and one for what's called social combat or verbal conflict, so on.
Yes.
Sort of Song of Ice and Fire RPG has that. Two combat chapters, one for social combat, one for physical combat. But RuneQuest that you're working on now, it is in the older category where you will role play social interactions.
It's primarily focused on the old school, but we do have some basic rules in there for social conflict too. So if you'd like to not role play your social interaction, we have rules built in for that to handle that kind of playstyle as well. Mm. It's just that they're not as in-depth because it's actually really difficult to make a mechanistic system about a piece of verbal communication. It's really tough. And it's really tough to hold yourself to those rules.
Yeah.
Because you will get excited or you will get impassioned and you will want to soliloquy your opponent. And suddenly you go, oh... Perhaps I should have actually rolled there, and I forgot.
But we were talking about how combat earlier, it's not winning, losing, it's so much more complex.
Yes.
And then combat still looks really simple compared to social interactions. Have I ever been in a social situation where I won? Probably not since I argued with my little brother as a kid. It just don't exist that way.
No. It is very tough to hold yourself to a framework of social combat if you actually want to deeply roleplay it. Because I find it tends to interfere with my roleplaying of it. Keeps on kicking me out of character, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
I'm happier with being kicked out of character for a combat situation, but even so, with the way RuneQuest is designed, you can actually roleplay with the combat relatively easily now because most of the things are just handled for you on the side. And so that's nice. Even to the point where I do have one of the special effects in there is forced surrender. So... maybe not for characters to use on other characters, but definitely for characters to use on non-player characters. To say, you know, you don't have to even finish him off in any particular way or disarm him or render him helpless. You could even just intimidate him into ending the fight there and then by doing a good enough role and scaring him, I suppose. But, yeah, it's an old school game of great heritage, and it is still primarily focused on the mechanistic side to that style of play. But You know, we have included passions, we have included social combat, as it's called. I'm not sure I'm particularly happy with that as a descriptive word. But...
Yes, social interactions is seldom best described as combat.
Yeah. And so passions are definitely an important aspect of the game. Have you ever played Pendragon?
I have read it and wanted to take it to the table quite a long time, but never actually played it. So I know what passions are in Pendragon, but maybe what our two listeners don't.
Okay, so a passion can be anything from...
And this is a RuneQuest passion, and we are leaving Pendragon behind.
This is RuneQuest passions. So it's anything from love the person you love. So maybe love mother or love wife or love husband, love horse.
You shouldn't have said that after husband.
Well, let us take a genre such as, say, Western.
Yeah.
And Lone Ranger. Hi-ho.
Silver.
And he loves his horse. He would never let anything happen to his horse. And that, there, straight away, role-playing aspect. I can use that as a GM. I can use that as a player. I can have a lot of fun with it. So, you know, do I leave my horse in the stable where I don't trust the stableman? Or does someone steal my horse? Or if I'm caught in combat, do I actually try and get off my horse and run away from my horse so my poor horse doesn't get hurt? So it can be anything as simple as a love or hate, and hate is obviously a far more dramatic, confrontational kind of thing, all the way through to...
Wanting to find an object.
Belief in a moral concept, pacifism. And you have a percentage value, just like a skill in Call of Cthulhu, and that percentage shows the strength of your passion. And so in a role-playing context, the GM may turn around and say, you're pacifistic. Why are you threatening the barman? Roll against your pacifism skill to see if you can do it. Or the GM doesn't need to be so confrontational.
And then you would have to fail the roll in order to threaten him.
To do it. Yeah. But, you know, as a GM, I might not want to force my players into those situations. But what happens if I've got passion for pacifism, and I've also got passion of love wife, and the barman is trying to feel up my girlfriend? Now what do I do? I've got both of these passions which are conflicting in this situation. And so there are all kinds of interesting rules in there saying, well, do you roll against both, or do you roll against one versus the other as a resistance roll? Or do you choose the highest value one in this situation? So
there's and you can still just wrong play it if you want. But if you want to back off of it and say, I see what the rules compel me to do, there is support for that.
Yes. And if you wanted to just say, okay, in this situation, I know I'm a true pacifist with 90% in my passion, but he's feeding up my wife, and I think this is really bad, so I'm going to hit him anyway. So that's fine. And now what we'll do is we'll reduce your pacifism passion a few percent, because you've just broken your own belief. And now you've made an exception to the rule once. Of course, you'll be more inclined to make exceptions in the future. Or perhaps you won't. Perhaps you'll redouble your efforts to try and become a true pacifist and never. And so I believe that the passion system is a very useful tool. But of course, you don't need to use them. If we say there, big black letters, you do not need to use these if you feel uncomfortable or you don't believe your players will enjoy them.
But it's a help.
But it's a help.
When you want to build into the sort of play for the first time, perhaps.
And a fun and easy way to add character depth.
It adds character depth, and we, Lawrence, has been running an Arthurian, Dark Age Arthurian campaign based on the Bernard Cornwell books, The Winter King. So we're basically taking the main protagonist parts in The Winter King, and we're interacting with all those characters there. And we all have our own passions, and it's the passions which are driving the campaign and the plotline, because we have well and truly left the storyline of the books well behind now. Primarily because of him, but But it's amazing. Those passions, they drive the campaign and they take it in totally new directions. And it's wonderful because it adds, you know, this random element.
After a while, the adventures start writing themselves.
Precisely.
The Game Master doesn't have to prepare as much or at all once the social, the feelings, the passions, the desires of the characters, it becomes a self-feeding engine just driving the story forwards.
And it's wonderful. It's been a... I think of all the new additions we've made to the game, that one is the most important one. Even though they're relatively simplistic, and they're only a couple of pages of rules, if that, but they're very, very important. After I played Pendragon for many years, I already knew the power of these as a role-playing tool. And now that we've added them formally into RuneQuest, I think they'll be a very useful addition to a lot of players and a lot of GMs.
What I found when making characters to RuneQuest in our particular group is that we spend at least as much time, if not more time, making up the passions for our characters as we are actually making them down on paper.
And it can put you in a great deal of role-playing stress as well. In the current game that we're currently playing, we're a group of children who were taken from post-World War II Britain and have ended up in a fantasy world.
Oh, that's a novel idea. that sounds interesting.
Then I accidentally killed someone.
Okay. And now, of course, we've grown up in this world. Okay. And we're not High King Peter or any of those guys. But we've actually... I mean, it's a cruel, nasty world. It's not a beautiful, wonderful world. And so we've been sliding down the moral slope bit by bit, some of us faster than others. And one of my primary passions is my love, not kind of like a romantic love, but my kind of familial love towards my best friend, because we both lost our parents at the same time, because we both ended up as orphans during character generation. And so we stick through thick and thin, and we survived our first experiences in this world by sticking together. Now we've grown up, and now we've become far more dubious of character. My best friend, who I will do anything to save, has turned into a psychotic alcoholic of
epic really proportions.
Of self-destructive proportions, to the point where he's starting to bring a terrible amount of trouble down upon our heads. Yet, although I want to turn around and kick him into submission and say, stop being an idiot, I have my passion to support and protect him at all times, because he always supports and protects me, and it's that kind of self-destructive relationship. And it's wonderful, it gives depth.
Yeah.
And it means that there's good reason for me to just not walk away from him in the campaign and leave the game.
Yeah, if our three characters didn't have this sort of connection, we would probably have killed each other long ago.
But
or at least betrayed each other.
What does it give you to have it on a system level?
Because you can, of course, you could have role-played
the same thing.
I could have role-played the same thing, but having it there on my character sheet in front of me, constant reminder, and every once in a while I'm sure that that skill value will change as well to reflect my increasing or decreasing strength of passion. Yes, when it comes down to it, everything we do in a role-playing game, we could just purely role-play without any kind of system support. But at some point it's always nice to have a framework to work within. And as I said, to just rest certain bits of your brain or free up certain bits of your brain so you don't have to worry about keeping track of other stuff.
Yeah.
Because especially in a role-playing game where you're playing on a weekly or even a monthly basis, it can be quite difficult to remember the subtleties of our last role-playing interaction. I might completely forget that I did this for you or you did this for me. And then when I start the game again, suddenly it's all... I completely miss an obvious bit. And then the person I'm playing gets remembers it because it was important to him. And, you know, you start getting that disconnect.
So it's a support framework.
It's a support framework.
Yeah, to lessen workload.
Yeah, because I like to concentrate on the moment, on the interaction, on the depth of feeling my character's performing. And I am getting older, and I do forget things, and if I don't have that support there all the time, there's also a question of inconsistency in GMing as well, which kind of gets frustrating a bit as well. Especially in things like freeform magic. That can be a problem. Wait a minute, I destroyed that city last week when I expended 4 magic points. Why can I only just briefly light this torch today with the same number of magic points? Okay, that's an extreme example, but you understand what I mean. So, yeah. Strictly, you don't need anything in a game.
No,
I think my theory is you always need something. If you don't have rules, you will need something else to create the social consensus. You always need something.
Not always. There's one campaign I've been involved with my friend down in Africa, which has been a colonialism. Have you ever read the Flashman books?
Okay. The bad guy from Tom Brown's school days.
Yes.
Sort of became the hero of this.
He's a horrible cad. Yeah. He's a sexist, violent, terrible coward. He's like a horrible coward. But somehow he always ends up in these situations where he emerges as the hero and people remember him fondly and he gets these decorations and promotions and things. So it's a very humorous, but also an in-depth look on the issues of cultures at that time. And they're very good as history books, but entertaining at the same time. So we were playing a campaign in that situation.
But then you had the book.
That was the concept behind it. We're playing sort of not particularly heroic people who are probably out for their own type of thing, set in early Victorian expansionism across the globe. And we had no rules. It was purely my friend being the GM, and all he had was a D6, which he used to help him make decisions. There were no rules. We just had to write 3 or 4 paragraphs of who we were, what we did when we were growing up, and what we do now. And that was it. And we just free-formed game from that point onwards.
Yeah.
And it was pure story game.
But did you have consensus on what sort of world you were playing in?
No. We were just told we were playing this world.
Oh, well, but you agreed to that. You would have consensus. You would. Oh, we were playing the Flashman books role-playing game. Right, cool. We do that. Then you establish
that consensus. No. Okay. You look at it from a different direction and perspective than I do. I don't think of things in the terms of consensus towards. It was just like Howard wanted to run a game, we said yes, he said do this, we did it, and then we started playing.
But you were informed. You had even for we're playing in this world, for example.
We're playing in early Victorian age.
You have a consensus to everything.
Yeah, but I have played games when you pick a guy. No one really exactly knew how the world looked like. We had no system, nothing. And you always need something enough. You need enough of something to play the same game.
In that case, this campaign worked because of two things. First of all, we had a solid setting because it was a historical period. Number two is we had absolute trust in Howard to make the story entertaining, and we'd go along with anything. We'd say what we'd attempt to do, and he'd say if we succeeded or not, and the consequences of our actions.
Yeah.
And we had complete trust in him doing that.
And the system was, we trust Howard.
The system was, we trust Howard.
Yeah.
And that was it. No dice rolls, no nothing.
Yeah.
I quite like that system. Howard is a awesome dude. People like Howard, at least. I don't think I know this particular Howard.
He's an awesome Howard.
And I'd love to play a game like that. I'd like to run a game like that. But like we talked about the passions, they give you something.
Yes.
From the, and that's what I look at when I buy a new game. What does this game give me that I couldn't just sit in my chair and freeform everything.
What support?
Yeah. What support? In what areas do this game support me? And how? In what ways then does this support happen?
So in that kind of frame of reference, RuneQuest gives you a medium level of support. It gives you tactical mechanics. It gives you some good basic rules. But effectively, when conflict or tests or challenges come up, it's literally, I roll against my skill, you roll against yours, and let's see what happens. If it's opposed, or if it's not opposed, it's just you roll against your skill, see if you succeed or fail. And that's pretty much the game system. And then that's why things like D100 game mechanics fade into the background so much. It isn't, I have to look up tables, or I have to look up what the challenge level of this particular situation is, or nothing like that. It's just what I consider medium level crunch, to use one of these new terminology things. It's not particularly light, but it's not particularly heavy. Yeah, I think it's a good halfway medium, and that's why I've been using this system in its different forms for most of my role-playing life, because it just sits nicely out of the way.
I get the feeling that in regular play it will feel a bit like Call of Cthulhu when terms of rules complexity, but there is a little more if you want it.
There's a little more if you're into combat.
Yes.
And no silent.
No sanity. Oh, no, oh, that's... Oh, whoa! On the other hand, it's basic roleplay-ish, so it would be trivial to import the sanity mechanics if I wanted them.
Oh, that's the other strength of these kind of systems, is it's incredibly easy to tinker with them, or to bring in favourite rules from other systems and just plug them in. Very resilient. It's very difficult to break the game systems up. At a fundamental level.
I like when we have when there's a big game system, like it's in RuneQuest is quite a big, it covers a lot.
Yeah.
And when the book tells me how to tinker in an effective way, when it tells me, if you want a grittier, deadlier game, change this in this way. If you want a more swashbuckly game, change it in this way. Because some games, it's hard to figure out how to adjust.
Yes.
And I like getting us to support. How do we adjust this effectively?
That is part of the Game Master's chapter in the end of the book. It basically gives you suggestions about how to set things up and how to handle certain situations. Anything from consequences of killing or your players killing everything to how do I run a campaign without having too much combat. So we try to provide a fairly comprehensive level of support. To me, it's one of those aspects of book writing which is kind of frustrating, because to me it's common sense and just good GMing. But of course, as you always say, you know, if you've got newbies coming into the game or inexperienced people, they might need some good advice to help them with these kind of things. So it's a necessary bit that you should put in a book. I have to say that RuneQuest isn't designed specifically for novice players. We have a web link in the front of the book that basically says, if you want to learn about role-playing in general, go to this site.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to take up 10 pages talking about what role-playing games are and how to play them.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's unnecessary, but it will be... most of our customers
will not need that,
and therefore we can use the pages for something
And else. Often implicit learning is just as effective.
True.
You will understand what a role-playing game is by reading the book, without even if the book don't include an explanation.
Understand it out of the context.
Yeah.
I have two items on my agenda. First, I want to talk about Kyle, and then I will go on a personal crusade here. But first, Kyle. 2 weeks ago-ish, I did an interview with Kyle, who lives in Korea. And in Korea, they have a gaming scene, but it is very, very fragmented. It's rare for people to be able to join a group to learn how to game.
Hmm.
So groups form spontaneously and together, or they learn from the internet, because there are pages, videos, tutorials instructing them for how do you play a role-playing game. So that, because it's a very prestige, not lose your face in public society. So to come in as a beginner into a game, you risk losing face. And that is an obstacle for you to join the community. So they have like websites describing, this is a role-playing game, this is how you play the game, this is what you are expected to do at the table when you are a player, this is what you are expected to do when you are the game master. So you can actually join, become a gamer with your friends, and none of you will have previous gaming experience, which I think is hard in the Swedish scene and as well in the international scene, in the English-speaking scene. You have to learn gaming from a gamer. It's a, this master-apprentice system.
Yes.
In a way.
I think Sith Lords had it right.
So much for, and I think it's awesome that they have this. He told me about that. What? That's a cool idea. And the other, my personal crusade zone, the Game Master chapter. And even if I get RuneQuest, I will still read that chapter. I've been a Game Master for over 20 years. I will still take and read that chapter, because that informs me on the guy who wrote this. This is how he envisions that this game will be played. These are his conventions for gaming.
Yes. As long as you take it as merely suggestions or words of wisdom,
yes.
And not as the one true way.
But those who come advice and words of wisdom still come from one certain perspective.
True. It's just that there is an implicit danger that people will pick up, read the GM's chapter and say, "Ah, oh, yes, but this is what Gygax meant when he wrote this. And this is the way you're supposed to play it." And they say, no, it's just advice.
Yeah.
You play the game the way you want to play it.
But, Gygax, well, I haven't read his instruction. I have read his book, Game Mastery. But not any of his actual gaming books. Not uncommon for Swedish gamers to not have any Dungeons & Dragons experience. That this is how he played it. If I want to have the experience that he wanted to give me, I should play it like this. Of course, I can tweak this, I can change it, I can ignore bits of it, but then I will be playing my own game. I will not be playing the way it was written and envisioned to play. Perhaps my way is more interesting, perhaps it's more fun, but it is different.
True. But I agree with all of that. But anybody who reads the GM's chapter that Buzz and I have created, just remember at the front of the book, we say, make RuneQuest your game and have as much fun as you want with it.
Yeah.
Don't be tied down to concepts that we as old gits have succumbed to over our role-playing careers. Because I'm hoping that people will take RuneQuest and go, aha. No, not aha. I want them to go, wow, I can use this to do that. And then I want them to come back in a few months' time and say, hey, Pete and Lars, I use RuneQuest to run David Gemmell's Legend or Tolkien's Silmarillion kind of thing. Or I've used it to play Starsky and Hutch cops in 70s New York. You know, I want them to basically take the game and run with it.
You want to sell a tool, not an experience.
Yes, it's a tool. If you can pick it up and you go, oh yeah, this is just dripping with sword and sorcery, because that's the way we've written it. But I want people to read between the lines and say, oh wow, this is just the perfect tool for me to do X, Y, and Z. Just as people have taken Savage Worlds and gone, Savage Worlds, everything. And so, I mean, I play Savage Worlds. I like it. But, you know, I generally go back to RuneQuest or Call of Cthulhu or those things to do more. It's a system I'm more comfortable with.
I will beat my own drum here. And earlier today we played one of my games, yes. Dots of Rona, and I sell experience, not tools.
Yep.
And I find that most of these new rules, like indie games, the story games, that kind of games, they are very specific that they sell not tools, but experience.
Experience.
Whereas most of the older Dungeons & Dragons RuneQuest...
And all the universal...
All the GURPS.
Yeah.
They sell a tool.
Yeah.
I don't say or think or mean that one of these is better than the other, but they are different things.
They are different things. Now, now that RuneQuest is finished and it's off to the publishers and everything like that, and we're just waiting for the actual physical copies, I'm currently working on a series of articles. So my first one is literally how to use RuneQuest to play Star Wars. My next one will be how to use RuneQuest to play in the Pliocene Exiles Many Colored Land series, which I don't know if you've ever read. Julian May, metapsychics back in the Pliocene period. Well, it's something I recommend you read.
It's awesome.
Metapsychics, but aliens, and these are, it's the racial memories of these things which give us the concept of the Fae, so elves and dwarves and things like that today.
They play a minor part in Irish mythology, I think.
Then Calvin. I'll do a James Bond one. Then I'm probably going to do some kind of fantasy. So these are just going to be little articles to show you how flexible and how easy it is to tweak the game system. But my first support book is definitely a sword and sorcery setting based on an island. That's just to show that Loz and I will be trying to provide support and inspiration to people who kind of decide to try and use our game system.
I think it's kind of way to try to believe that you really can settle experience. Because what you send to the players, unless you're in the room, is a tool. And it will never be more than a tool.
Yes, of course. You are right in that. As soon as someone takes my game and reads it, they have already changed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they are the other people than I am. Hopefully they will get an experience similar to the one I hope for. But yes, I can't sell them the experience, really. I want to sell them the experience, but I can't. In the same way that a movie is selling the experience, but depending on who you are, you will focus on different things when you watch a movie. So you will see the same movie, but you will focus on different things.
Which is one of the most difficult aspects of writing games, because every person who reads what you've written will interpret it in slightly different ways, to the point of deliberately misreading it in an abusive way to break it as best as possible. Or, on the other extreme, to misinterpret what you're saying as your personal support for various different bad things in life, which is also not particularly good. But it is very, very difficult to write something that is just easy and simple and clear and lucid and can be taken in the spirit that is written.
The cutest way to misinterpret it is when someone goes all fanboy and thinks it's divine wisdom.
I've had some things I've written where people think I'm being far more clever than I really am. Which in some situations is very nice to have, but in other situations I say, I'm not actually that smart. I'm reasonably well educated. I like to think I'm an intelligent bloke, but when it comes down to it, you know, you use bigger words than me. Or you read deeper levels of conspiracy into it than I do, or you, whatever. It's an interesting situation, and you're always faced with that moment of, do I admit that it was a mistake, or do I admit that you just come up with a more brilliant idea, or do I just claim it and try to sort of like keep an aloof nature?
Yes, of course, that was what I meant. Yeah.
Now, the best one for that is if somebody's really deep, trying to read deeper messages into the mythos of what you've already written, is they'll come up with an idea, and then you'll just take an aspect of it and you say, yes, but have you thought about this? And then you walk away. And that really mind fucks them. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't use the F word on the podcast. But
it's a Swedish podcast.
Okay.
Yes.
But we can cut it down.
Curse words are not as bad for us because we are exposed to English through American action movies.
No,
and there they swear all the time.
Yeah.
So when we learn English and then we go speak to native speakers, like we come from American action movies, I'm like, what?
Oh, yeah.
Fucking shit, fuck.
The most recent compliment I got from English is, Elin always gets the swear words right.
That's important.
Yeah.
And then the discussion drifted away into other topics again. I hope you have enjoyed this discussion on RuneQuest and the upcoming new edition. And if you want more information about it, I have posted a link to the game's official website in the show notes.